Hey, Kelsey.
Hey, Brooke.
Want to tell everyone what's happening in today's episode?
In today's episode, our girl Rachel is interviewing Emma Southen, who is the new author of A Rome of One's Own. And I'm so excited to learn more.
Me too. Let's go.
Hello, and welcome to Remedial Her Story, The Other 50%, the podcast that explores what happened to the women in history class. Now, here's your host, Kelsey Brooke Eckert, and her partner in crime, Brooke Neva Sullivan.
So, Brooke, our girl Rachel, who is the host of the Hashtag History Podcast, has joined us again to interview Emma Southen. Emma is the author of a new book, A Rome of One's Own, The Forgotten Women of the Roman Empire, where she profiles 21 Roman women.
What?
Yeah.
Thanks. I know. Oh, 21?
21.
Casual. Not just 20.
Yeah.
One more.
21. Lucky 21.
Old enough to drink back then.
Yep.
Yeah, Emma looks like a baddie. So she also is the co-host of a really funny podcast that I adore, History is Sexy, with, I'm going to say this hopefully correct, Jania Matheson?
Yeah.
So Emma is a PhD of ancient Latin antique history at the university, from the University of Birmingham. She received her PhD from there. She's published several things, which is pretty cool. But also she really goes hard for the Romans, which I love. Emma seems like kind of a really cool person and is really giving it to us when it comes to comedy and history, which I always am down for. So I'm excited about this book. So Rachel got to talk to her.
Yeah. And the book, so like I said, her book profiles 21 relatively unknown women. And what's neat about it is she's selected women sort of across the span of Roman history. So all the way back from like selecting a Sabine woman who was kidnapped by the Romans in the founding myth of the Roman Empire, and then all the way up through into the Common Era. So I'm excited because, you know, I feel like the women who make Roman history a lot are the ones who like are right next to the male story. And I'm excited to sort of hear about some of these like lesser known women.
And, you know, as an educator, you probably have a hard time going so deep on the Roman Empire. But I feel like in recent TikTok days, men have really brought the Roman Empire back for no reason. So I feel like this is very pertinent to make sure women are up to speed. Yeah, apparently, men think about it 24/7.
Yeah. But also, like, women don't because they don't realize that, like,
it's so many women exist
in history, right?
Yeah. So here we go. This is our chance, ladies, to get in on the TikTok trend that is men in the Roman Empire and finally bring women to the forefront.
Right, exactly.
Let's let Emma kill it for us.
Right, I know. So before we turn it over to Rachel and Emma, I'm so excited to just talk about our nonprofit and all of the like great growth that we're experiencing this year, and remind everybody that you can go to remedialherstory.com/giving, and you can also find us on Patreon and become a supporter of our nonprofit.
That we put free resources in teachers' hands.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do.
I'm so excited. We're in the middle of expanding a lot of the resources. So we have all of our resources are being modified for middle school. We also just finished up a grant from the Library of Congress where we produced 40 more inquiry-based lesson plans for teachers to use in their classrooms. So I'm just so excited. There's so many amazing resources on our website for every era and region of world history and U.S. history. We're changing it. And it's so neat, you know, for people who are like, do people even use these? Yes. Every day my inbox is like, bing, 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 as teachers are downloading lesson plans off our website. And, you know, donations to the Remedial History Project keep the website running. Like that's thousands of dollars just to like have the website up every year. Every penny that people can give to our work helps and it makes it available and helps, you know, one teacher has, you know, between, I don't know, 30 to 80 kids on their caseload every year. And one teacher can like completely change that sort of grassroots vibe, which is what we're going for, can totally change the educational experiences of boys and girls in their classes.
Totally change. The ripple effect is real. And so, it's exciting. But all the donations that we get it goes pretty far for us. You know, we try and stretch our dollars as much as we can for operational costs and things that we're doing and getting free resources and getting out to events. Getting things in the hands of teachers is the goal.
Yeah. Yeah. So tell a friend, and you can find us at remedialhistory.com/giving. So speaking of reminding people that women exist in history, let's turn it back to Rachel and Emma to learn more about a Rome of one's own.
Take it away.
My name is Emma Southern. I am an ancient historian. I live in Northern Ireland. I have a PhD in ancient history, or ancient and medieval history officially. And then I left academia immediately after finishing my PhD because it's horrible, and started writing books. And started writing books that were slightly more fun for non-academics, and kind of started writing the books that I wanted to read, really, that are entertaining, but also informative, and which do history and historiography as well, and will tell you the good stories, but will also tell you how we know those good stories and how complicated those stories are, about the Roman world, which is the place that I love and hate the most. And the book that I have out right now, which is the one we're going to talk about, is called A Rome of One's Own. And it is a history of the Roman Empire, basically starting with the foundation of Rome and going through to the fall of the Western Roman Empire in about 476, through the lives of 21 women from all over the empire. Ones that you will not have heard of, who have exciting stories that tell you different things about the Roman Empire and how complicated and weird it is, and also how much more there is to Roman history and to the Roman Empire than just battles and Julius Caesar and Cicero and Marcus Aurelius.
I had no idea there was more to it than that.
Judging from TikTok, that's all anybody thinks there is. But
and that's why I'm so, how many times can I use the word eager? But that's why I'm so eager to speak with you, because even as, so I was a history major, and obviously with this podcast, I'm so passionate about women's history and learning about the women that are often erased from history or just aren't well known. And yet, even through all of my research and my studies, I feel like I'm embarrassed to say that I can only name one or two big names, big female names in Roman history. And that's really sad. Why is that?
Partly it is because the sources that we used when we talk about Roman history are so male focused. Mm-hmm. They're written by men. And when the Romans write about themselves, they very much tended to only write about the masculine sides of history. So they wrote about war, and they wrote about things that men were saying in the Senate. And then they wrote about what their emperors were doing in their bedrooms. And that is kind of it for the large part. Yeah. But then when we are talking about the Roman Empire, we are always looking at it through the lens of the kind of neoclassical empires that we descend from, the British Empire, which created America, the kind of these empires which idolized that version of Rome and which saw themselves as recreating Rome over and over again. So, you know, if you go into any capital city in the Western world, you're going to find loads of buildings that are government buildings that look disturbingly like Roman temples, because they all thought they were Cicero, or they all thought they were Caesar when they were creating their constitutions or creating their empires. And so they, when they wrote the histories that we ended up growing up on, they also erased the women from it because they only wanted to tell us the stories that valorize themselves. And so we've got two layers of women being rubbed out, but they are tenacious. Women cling on in the corners somewhere, and there are so many of them when you look, when you kind of push aside those narratives about what Rome is and what people want Rome to be. There's about 50% of the population of the Roman Empire, it turns out, were women. And some of them write about themselves, and some of them left marks of their own name written in stone to make sure that it would survive. And some of them were memorialized by men as mostly as kind of monsters, but sometimes as shining, glorious examples of imaginary virtue. But they're there and they're doing stuff. You just have to dig a bit.
I so appreciate that, because I think that one of the arguments that historians that or educators or just history lovers in general that speak on women's history one of the arguments that we receive a lot of the time is that there isn't enough documentation of women in history, or, you know, the reason why we don't learn more about women is because there just isn't anything out there. There aren't documents about their accomplishments and their everyday lives, but there is. It's just a deliberate erasure of it is what I have found in my studying.
Yeah, very much so. And you find that either it's erased deliberately, like, or it's just not recorded when it's rewritten. So it's just considered to be less important. So, for example, the beginning of the book tells the story of the foundation of Rome, but instead of focusing on Romulus, I focused on the Sabine women and Tarpeia. So Hersilia, who ends up being Romulus's wife, who is kidnapped from her family by the Roman men, and Tarpeia, who's the woman who lets the Sabines into Rome and causes the big fight that the Sabine women finish. And you can read a million versions of the foundation of Rome story in modern history books, and you will never find Hersilia's name in there.
Wow.
She's mythical, obviously, but she's no more mythical than Romulus is. And you'll always find the Romulus and Remus story, and then it will skip to the kings. And the women who were there, the women who were a vital part of it, and the fact that this war happens, like this foundational war occurs in Roman history because Romulus has founded a city that has no women in it. And you cannot have a society and a culture and a like a city without women. You can't. Men don't asexually reproduce, so you do need women around. And so it's really, really important that they have women in Rome, and it's really important that women are part of that story. But when people tell the foundation story, they just skip that part over. They go, they needed women. They're nameless. They'll name Titus Tatius, and they'll name all of these other men, but they'll never name the women or include them, which is a deliberate choice as to what is interesting about this story. And so I decided to add that back in. But sometimes you just have to look outside of the traditional sources. So sometimes there aren't any women in the narratives because no, Livy didn't write about it or whatever. But there's always women in the archaeology. There's always women writing their name down somewhere. Often you will find that male scholars will try to say that those weren't written by women. just the second phase of erasing women from history, which is that you say a woman didn't write it. You go, oh, it's just a man pretending to be a woman. Sure. But sometimes you find a woman that you can't erase. But there will always be someone trying to have a go to declare that women were incompetent in the past or were invisible when they weren't.
I think that you touched on exactly what I wanted to touch on next, in that I wonder how daunting the research process was for you, because I know it's so difficult to find women's names and find women's accomplishments in history that is written by men and women have been deliberately erased from. So can you walk me through even that research process?
Yes, so I separated it out into the phases of Roman history. So I knew I wanted every kind of period of Roman history in it. I wanted the foundation and the kingdom. Then I wanted all three phases of the Republic, and then the kind of early imperial, high imperial, late antiquity. So I knew I wanted to do all of it, and I knew I didn't want anything clustered. So that meant that I was looking for women within specific phases. I like to divide things up into manageable tasks. So.
Definitely. when you're tackling Rome, one must go in steps.
Exactly. And then I kind of went looking, and in certain times, there's so many women that you can include, but they're almost all women of a certain class, very powerful women in Rome. And I also wanted to spread that out. So I basically went and got as many books as I could on women in the ancient world, and like a big book on, there's a great book which is specifically women in Latin epigraphy, and went through and made massive lists of all the women that I could include, and chose all of these women from as many different source materials as I could. Basically, I ended up with hundreds of women on my list that I then tried to narrow down. The only period they were difficult to find women for was the early Republic. because all of the stories of that period are just men doing a war and people arguing over land, and it's so boring. sorry, anyone who's an early Republican, but awful period of history. Apart from that, there were just so many that I could have chosen, and it could have been a history of the Roman Empire in 150 women. And I had to be quite cruel in cutting some people out because their stories overlapped. Yeah. but when you start looking in papyrography and epigraphy and graffiti and other places where that come down less mediated by men, you find a lot of women lurking there.
I love that. And I really like too that you acknowledge that parts of this is side tangent from your book, but just history and studying history in general, that there are components of history that are boring. Okay that not all of us love it. But so what I love that you do with your work is make history interesting and fun and entertaining and attainable for even people that maybe don't view themselves necessarily as history lovers. I think that's really important. Yeah. The only way that you can get people interested in history is if you make it interesting. So I really appreciate that.
I think when you sell history to people, it's basically soap operas about the past. Which is what so much of it is. I think a lot of the history that you learn in school is either just lists of dates or...
Yes.
I did a lot of World War II history because that's what we got taught when I was in school. And it was just lists of dates and treaties, and it was interminable and awful. And it's only because I got into ancient history, which turned out to be a soap opera in the past with just the wildest people having sex with their sisters. And how is this going to turn out? That I realized that history is not just lists of dates and one thing after another. It's history is people. It's what people have done in the past and how that affected other people around them. And people are really fun and silly and sometimes frustrating, and sometimes storylines go in wild directions. and that is kind of what I always want to communicate to people, is that history is people. And if you like people and you like the stories of people and how varied and exciting and silly and sometimes very stupid and dramatic and selfish and good they are, then you should love history, really, because it's but in togas.
That was really beautiful. I entirely agree. You just made me passionate about history all over again, because I feel the exact same way about history, that a lot of what I learned growing up was not necessarily exciting. It was wars and battles and dates and treaties. And but once you find that one thing, just that one thing that piques your interest, then you go down a rabbit hole. And so I'm sure that's a lot of studying ancient history, what drew you in on that broad topic. But for A Rome of One's Own, what was the starting point? Was there one story in particular, one woman in particular that piqued your interest, that made you passionate about this project and highlighting forgotten women in Roman history?
I always feel kind of bad saying this because it partly started out of spite, which is that there is a very big trend in publishing at the moment for Greek mythology retellings and like rescuing women from the kind of horrors of the way that their stories have been told for a very long time. But when you become an ancient historian, you pick a side, basically. You either become a Greek person or you become a Latin person. And I'm a kind of purebred Latin person. And I kept seeing all of these Greek people getting all of the attention, and I felt like somebody needed to step in and be like, hey, Romans have women too, and even better, they're real. So that was kind of the impetus, was I wanted to write about Roman women, and then I wanted to make it a historical rather than mythological, really. The impetus for writing it as I did was actually a modern historian, and it's the book that's the story that's right at the beginning of the book, which is a story from Amy Rieschlin about how she... when she was an undergraduate in the 1970s in the Ivy League university, asked a professor if they could have a module on women in Roman history. And the professor said to her and her colleagues that you may as well do a module on Roman dogs, because that was how important women were to history.
That is awful.
Yeah. And her response, because she's a great woman, was to basically go, no, they aren't. You can't believe you would say that to our faces, but sure. And to basically become one of the preeminent feminist scholars of classics and of Roman literature. And she's still working today and she's still amazing. And a lot of her work, but finding that anecdote when I first kind of started to read around the topic and just be like, why is that so recent? Like, she's the same age as my PhD supervisor. Like, I'm basically like the next generation after her. It's ludicrous that that happened so recently. And it's ludicrous that this is kind of one of the first books for the public audience about women in the ancient world when women have been working on the ancient world for 100 years. So it was more of a modern stories that, and my desire to kind of contribute a bit about how the Roman world is interesting in that way, and how women are important to the Roman world, to those people who are still around, and potentially that professor is still alive and working as well. I mean, Roman dogs, a book on, would probably be quite interesting, but women are more important than dogs. Sorry.
Sorry to all the dog lovers.
Yeah. And telling their stories is as interesting as telling the story of what Cicero did in the 14th of December, 44 AD.
I love that so much. And I think that you can certainly be inspired by spite. And that antidote is something that would put a fire in my belly, too. So before we kind of divert to talk about really the importance of telling these stories and why the next generation of students needs to learn them, would you be willing to share about your choice, one, two, or three women that you cover in the book, just a couple of fascinating tidbits about these women and why we should know about them?
The one that I've been thinking about loads at the moment, because my mom just came back from Egypt and she took pictures of her poems, is Julia Balbia, who was in Hadrian's court. And she was a Syrian, she's from Comain, which is in what is now Syria. She descended from the royal family of Comain, who were absorbed into the Roman Empire by Hadrian's predecessor. And she is a royal woman. Her brother became a senator and was very important in Athens. She's very, very rich. She lives this kind of charmed and beautiful and wonderful life. And she hangs out with Hadrian and his wife all the time. But the only reason that we know she ever existed is that when they were in Egypt together, they visited these statues, which were known by the Romans as the Colossi of Memnon. They're actually statues of Amenhotep III. But the Romans had no interest in other people's cultures, sure. So they just renamed everything. And they were famous in the Roman world because they sang in the morning. So when the dawn broke, as the sunlight hit the statue, it would make a noise, and the Romans thought that they were singing. It was kind of a bang noise. And it's thought that it was moisture evaporating inside the statue. It only happened for a 200-year period, because there was an earthquake which shifted, kind of half broke one of them. And it sang for this 200-year period and became quite famous as a tourist attraction. But then Septimius Severus, the emperor, tried to renovate the statue and fixed it and destroyed the thing that was making it sing by accident.
Fixed it and ruined it all at once.
Yeah. But for 200 years, it was this tourist attraction. But and Romans would go there and they would write their names on it to say that they had been there. Because everybody wants to say that they existed. And Julia Balbia wrote four poems, which she put on the leg of this statue. They're quite long. And they are, one of them is about Sabina, the wife of the empress, and is about how pretty she is, which is really nice. And about how Memnon didn't sing that day because he wanted to see Sabina again because she was so pretty. He wanted to entice her back the second day, which is a very sweet poem. And then she writes two, which basically just showing off. One is about the mythology of Memnon and Amenhotep. And the second one is about her family, and just basically lists her family and her. She's like, I am Julia Balbia. This is my brother. This is my father. This is my mother. This is where I came from. This is who I am. You cannot attribute any of this to anybody else. This is me. And they're written in Aeolic Greek, which is a dead language by the time she's writing. So she's writing in the 2nd century CE. It is the language of Sappho. So 800 BCE, sort of. It's a dead poetic language that she knows. So she's very, very educated, and she's writing in this very poetic language, which only some people will be able to read. Mm. But she goes so far out of her way to say, I am me. I have this royal and Roman heritage, which is mixed, and I was here, and I'm smart, and I like my friend. And as a result, her poems are kind of mediocre, which makes it even more charming that she's not even particularly good, but she works really hard at it, and she just wants the world to know that she existed and that she likes her friend. And what makes it even sweeter is that we have the date of that visit, and it's about 2 or 3 weeks after Hadrian's boyfriend Antonius died, and he died drowning in the Nile. And Hadrian lost his mind over Antonius's death, made him a god, put statues of him everywhere, named like 3 cities after him, made everybody worship him, was like very upset that this boy had died while his wife is with him.
Wow.
And so this story about Sabina being the prettiest woman and Memnon wanting to look at her takes on this whole resonance of her trying to be really nice to Sabina while her husband is obviously just disrespecting her in front of the whole world. It's like, definitely, I still think you're pretty and the gods still love you. That's delightful.
I love this. I feel like that story showed 2 really great examples of someone in history that just has so much personality. This is why studying history is so important, because these are people. And if you, like you said, if you love people watching and you love gossip and you love drama, she fits all of that. And I think that that's something you don't often find with ancient women, for one. And then the second thing I think a great demonstration of is oftentimes you're not able to place women in history either. And so the fact that you're able to nail her down in just a matter of weeks to another really important date is really fascinating.
It is. And if she hadn't written her name and she hadn't gone out of her way to say, I'm Julia Balbia, this is my mother's name, this is my father's name, this is my grandfather's name, then you wouldn't, like, there's other poems by women on the statue, but because they just left a single name, we can't place them in that same way. But she just really wanted everyone who saw that to know forever that she was who she was, and she had a special lineage. And her brother has this enormous tomb in Athens. It's massive. It's got his name all over it and about 17 statues of him on it. But from that, you would not know that she existed, even though she probably built it. But she went out of her way to really make sure that people knew that she lived. And I love that.
I love that so much. Someone with so much personality. And I feel like that's foreshadowing. She was speaking to you, and she was speaking to other, you know, historians, saying like, hey, I existed, because we're reading over the text trying to find you. I love that she was speaking to historians hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years later.
And the kind of imaginary version of her in my head knows that she will never have the statue that her brother had. Like, she's never going to get this enormous tomb that's got 3 stories, because she's not a senator, she wasn't like in the Greek parliament, but this is the only thing that she's ever going to get. So I love that.
I love that. Is there another woman you wouldn't mind highlighting for us?
So the other one I'm going to mention is Turia, whose name we don't actually know, because we have a good chunk of her epitaph, her tombstone, which her husband put up for her in the 1st century CE in Rome. So on the big road outside of Rome, Via Appia, he put up these 2 massive statues. They're like 6'8" high each. Actually, they're even taller than that, because I looked us up for a presentation. They are the same height as the tallest man who ever lived, who was 7'8", I think.
Wow.
So they're enormous. And they basically contain a huge, like, hundreds of lines worth of description of her life and all of the amazing things she did and how much he loved her. And all of the bits which say her name are lost.
Oh, because someone went through and scratched them out?
No, they were just in late antiquity. So their marble was reused, basically. So it was just when people wanted to start building churches and when people wanted to start putting in catacombs, a lot of them were found in, they just chopped up all the marble that they could find and reused it in other places in Rome. So I think 8 bits have been found in various different places. Some are just drawings. Some have been like when catacombs in churches, in the walls of buildings and things, and they were pieced together in the 19th century. But just the bits that would have her name just by pure coincidence are gone. Wow. And weirdly enough, we only know the name of her brother-in-law.
Where did her name come from then?
Yeah, so it's a potential identification because one of the things that is described in the book, in the epitaph, is the prescriptions which were enacted by Augustus and Mark Antony and Lepidus when they had 1,500 people killed who were their enemies, basically. And Turia's husband was one of these men. We don't know specifically who he was, but the story that is described on the epitaph is of Turia hiding her husband and protecting him and putting him in a safe place. And there is a book which describes lots and lots of people who were prescribed and how they reacted, and one of them describes a wife hiding her husband in an attic and then going and get him removed. So it's not quite the same, but it's close enough that people said maybe these are the same people. Okay. And so that wife is called Turia, and so they basically said it's maybe that's them. It would be nice to think that that's them. So that's where she gets her name from. But her husband is basically completely in awe of her and just thinks she's the most amazing person who ever existed. And it's full, like, they're married for 43 years and they're together before that because they're separated by the civil wars. So they're together for probably 45 years minimum. During the first civil wars between Julius Caesar and Pompey, her parents are murdered, and she single-handedly, as a single unmarried woman, prosecutes their murderers, so identifies them and prosecutes them. She then has another legal battle where another family tried to claim her and steal all of her money, and she just fights them so hard in the courts that they have to give up and go away because it's just not worth the fight, basically.
Wow.
She then moves in with her mother-in-law. Someone tries to invade their house during an uprising. And so she physically fights off people trying to invade their house.
She's amazing.
Yeah. And all of this is while she's maybe, like, she's probably not 20 before any of this happens.
Oh my God.
All of that happens. Eventually, she manages to liaise with Julius Caesar in order to get her husband back into the city safely. They are able to officially marry. And then he immediately chooses the wrong side again in the next civil war. So he was on the wrong side against Caesar. He was on Pompey's side. He lost that one. She gets him out of it. He chooses the wrong side again because he is like a fairly hardline optimate. He's anti-populism. And so she has to intervene again. She rescues him from being prescribed, so which means he'd be just executed in the street. And she talks to Augustus, Octavian, and gets him removed from the list, and then goes and throws herself on the ground in front of Lepidus, who is ruling Rome at the time, and refuses to leave until he makes such a scene that he agrees to, like, release her husband and let him be and restore him to everything and make him safe just to make her stop making a noise.
Oh, my God. Because
and she then basically resolves everything, and they enter this period of kind of peace and prosperity, and they go to have children. And it turns out that one of them is infertile. As a couple, they are infertile. They go through this real fertility journey that he describes as her trying everything under the sun, because they don't have an understanding of, like, joint infertility. It just has to be her fault.
Of course.
But she tries everything, and eventually she comes up with this plan that she wants him to have an heir because that's what he should have. And she believes that marriage should be for the production of children. And so she tells him that what she'll do is they'll divorce, and she will find him a young wife that he can marry and have children with, but she won't move out, and he will still look after all of her property. So he can still be her guardian, and she'll be there as like a sister-in-law. So basically she'll help him raise the children and they'll still be together, but legally he will be able to have his heirs. And he is so heartbroken by the fact that she would suggest this. He was like, I would never betray you. Like, we are in this marriage for more than just children. This is he's quite upset that she would even suggest this. And he says, no, I would rather have you than children, basically.
A progressive man.
So they stay together and they take in lots of relatives and like young women from the wider family that they provide dowries for, and they find them wives. And he talks about all of her brilliant decision making and how they're always happy to do whatever she says because she always has the best ideas. And then she dies. She's younger than him and he is like absolutely distraught. And he says, with you, all of my certainty and peace has been taken. And you deserved everything in the world, but it wasn't my ability to give it to you. And if the world was just, then I would have died first and you would have been able to live a life. And he is just completely bereft of her. And it's such a beautiful, like, he's so adoring of her, and she, at least in the way he tells it, is so adoring of him. And it's such a beautiful romantic story of a life lived together for 40, 50 years of like where they sacrifice for one another and where they genuinely love one another and they do good in their community. And it ends with him just being like, I just hope that I will be able to do all of your last wishes and that you find peace in the afterlife. And it ends sadly, but it's 45 years of them being a unit that's really lovely. And it's something you don't see in the ancient world very much. You mostly get this image of especially elite marriage because they are an elite, you know, he potentially was a consul and they are an elite family. Mm-hmm. As being, you know, marriage of convenience, they don't really like each other. They're certainly not in it because they are head over heels going to throw themselves on the floor in public in front of the consul in love with one another, but these two were, and he really wanted the whole world forever to know that.
I love that. Was so beautiful. That kind of gave me goosebumps. That was really beautiful, and I think it's exactly what you just said. Even today we are in awe of beautiful love stories like that, people that sacrifice for one another and love each other so wholeheartedly. Yeah. In today's day and age where there isn't the expectation that you are simply marrying to reproduce. And so that's really, really beautiful to see, particularly in ancient times.
Yeah. I love that. And if they were together for 45 years and he's older, so he's potentially 30 when they marry. So he's like in his 70s, maybe, when she dies, and this 70-year-old man like writing this and wanting everyone to know that his beautiful wife is just such a touching, like, lovely image that to know that that love existed in the ancient world is lovely.
That's beautiful. And something that I don't think we know or we don't think of when we think of the ancient world, that there were these beautiful love stories that they really, like you said, sacrificed for one another. And there was really an equal sharing of love there. So thank you so much for sharing those stories. And thank you for the work that you've done with this book. I know that it's important. I know that it's needed. But why do you think it's important that history teachers include these stories in their lessons? Or why do you think it's important even just for the general public to know of these women in ancient history?
I think it's important to know these stories because the way that we imagine the past changes what we think is normal. And if we think it's normal that women were invisible, if we think it's normal that women are not part of the stories that we tell about the ancient world, especially when we talk about ancient Rome, because it is so foundational to how the modern world imagines itself, or like the you know, the 19th century imagined itself as it built the modern world. If we imagine that that world did not include women, did not include women with a voice, did not include educated women, did not include women who had businesses and were in love and were a vital part of their husband's success, or even their own success, then it's so, so much harder to imagine women being a part of the modern world, and it makes it easier to say, oh, it's women aren't part of the public domain. Women are not part of politics and war, the only two important things. So I think it's really important to include stories of women existing and just being normal and successful and contributing to the world as it exists, because then you can understand that that's how it can be now as well. It's not an outlier. And a problem that I have with a lot of stories that are told about the past when they include women is that they tend to be stories of queens and stories of exceptional women, and they're mm-hmm. treated as though they are exceptional, and as though every other woman was locked in a kitchen or a basement right. or something. But they weren't. There were, to be a queen would tended to be exceptional in some circumstances, but other women were out and about living their lives, doing other stuff. And it, mm-hmm. you don't need to be exceptional to be important, and to be part of history. You can just be. And that's also important. So that's why I think that it should be a basic part of history to learn about what women were doing as well, not as a bolt-on or as a dogs in history, a kind of optional extra to right. history, as this is what history is and it includes women.
If we make up 50% of the population, you're missing out on 50% of history when you don't include us.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's really inspiring. I love that. So even though you got out of academia, if you were to put yourself in a classroom as an educator in the classroom setting, what is one lesson or activity that you would do with your students in relation to women in ancient history?
I was thinking about this because it's a long time since I taught anybody that wasn't an
adult. Teaching, yeah, I would say you're teaching people every day with your work.
Yeah. In a classroom setting, but I was thinking, I thought that what I would probably do is I would get my students to either describe or draw or write a description of a Roman woman. Like, what do you imagine when you think of a mm-hmm. Roman woman? You can, you know, draw that woman, write me a paragraph, get together and act me out something. How, you know, what's she wearing? What's she doing? Where is she? What's her name? And then I would interrogate what they came up with, because mm-hmm. I think that 99.9% of the time what they would come up with is an empress or a woman probably wearing some kind of toga. She would be in Rome, she would be white, she would be called Julia, and she would probably have lots of gold on. She wouldn't have a job, she would just spend all her time eating grapes, and she would be surrounded by enslaved people. Mm-hmm. And I would then want them to know, why does the enslaved woman standing next to her who did her hair not count as a woman mm. in this? Why was that not your Roman woman? Mm. What about all of the women in Egypt and Africa and Syria and Turkey and Cyprus and Germany and Gaul and Britain and France? Like, all of these women who are not, you know, a lot of these women are not white. Why are they not as mm. part of your discussion of what a Roman woman is? How are we defining Roman? In that case, what does it have to be? Somebody who is in Italy and in Rome? Do they have to be mm-hmm. rich? Why doesn't she have a job? What about all of these Roman doctors who are women that we know from epigraphy, or all of these, you know, Roman tile makers, these women who sell olive oil and have made a fortune? And so I would want to then break that down. What do we imagine a Roman woman to be? And how can we expand that to include all of the millions of other women that don't fit that model?
That's great, because a lesson like that helps to break down even unconscious bias, right? It's just the automatic image that comes to your mind, and you're not intentionally feeding into your bias and by not thinking of the enslaved person that is fanning her and feeding her grapes.
Yeah. But if you drew a picture, then I reckon that at least, you know, three or four people would draw an enslaved person next to her. And that sure. that would not. And like in old books, you get it less now, but you used to get a book on women and slaves. So you would have a Roman history book and then would have women and slaves. And you'd be like, mm-hmm. and all of the slaves would be uh-huh. enslaved men. And would never include enslaved women. And you'd be like, okay, right. so they just don't count. mm-hmm. And we're just, that's like a whole bunch of marginalizations that we're just shoving into one category, into a single chapter.
Very layered.
But that is really important to break down and ask ourselves why we do this. And then that's the first step in expanding these categories.
Thank you so much for talking with us. And again, for all the time and the research that you've put into this. It's really important work, and I'm really excited for our audience to hear you talk about it and to buy your book. Is there anything else that you'd like to share with us before we go?
Yeah, buy the book. That's got up to 5 jokes in it as well. Because I like to make myself laugh when I'm writing, and if I make other people laugh, then that is good. Yeah, hope it's got 21 good stories in it. So hopefully you will want to read them. I also have my own podcast, which is called History is Sexy, where I do all kinds of history. We answer questions from people who don't have the time to deep dive into history themselves, which is very fun. But
I'm subscribing right now. History is sexy.
History is sexy. Don't look it up on your work computer, because we discovered afterwards that after we named it, that it does get caught in filters. But
it's not safe for work, listeners.
It's not actively
subscribing right now. That sounds amazing. Subscribe.
So that's where you can find me if you would like to hear more.
Thank you so much again for coming on the podcast. It was really great speaking with you.
Thank you for having me.
Of course.
Thanks so much for listening to Remedial Her Story, The Other 50%. Please subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to your podcasts to bring more voices to the conversation. We really appreciate that effort. Until next time.